भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जायमुदीरयेत् नष्टप्रायेष्वभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवतीरुक्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्टिकी कृष्णाय वासुदेवाय देवकीनन्दनाय च नन्दगोपकुमाराय गोविन्दाय नमो नमः। Grantha Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 20, Chapter entitled The Rainy Season and Autumn, Verse 20. Megha go, me, okay, we'll, what? Megha agama utsavaha रिष्टः मेघागमोत्सवारिष्टा प्रत्यनन्दना चिकण्डिनः नन्दञ्चिकण्डिनः गृहेषु तप्तनिर्विण्णा गृहेषु तप्तनिर्विण्णा यथा अच्युत जन आगमे यथा अच्युत जनागमे मेघागमोत्सवारुष्टा प्रत्यनन्दन् शिखण्डिनः गृहेषु तप्तनिर्विण्णा यथाच्युतजनागमे मेघागमोत्सवारिष्टा प्रत्यनन्दन् शिखण्डिनः गृहेषु तप्तनिर्विण्णा यथाच्युतजनागमे मेघागमोत्सवारिष्टा प्रत्यनन्दन् शिखण्डिनः गृहेषु तप्तनिर्विण्णा यथाच्युतजनागमे Vaishnavis. word to word translation, megha of clouds, agama because of the arrival, utsavaha who celebrate a festival, rishtaha becoming joyful, pratyanandan they cried out in greeting, Shikhandinaha, Shikhandinaha, the peacocks, Griheshu, within their homes, Tapta, those who are distressed, Nirvinna, and then become happy, Yatha, just as, Achyuta, of the infallible personality of Godhead. Infallible personality of Godhead. Jana of the devotees. Agame upon the arrival. Translation and purport by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. Translation. The peacocks became festive and cried out a joyful greeting when they saw the clouds arrive. Just as people distressed in household life feel pleasure when the pure devotees of the infallible Supreme Lord visit them. Purport. After the dry summer season, the peacocks become jubilant with the arrival of the first thundering rain clouds, and thus they dance in great happiness. Srila Prabhupada comments, we have practical experience that many of our students were dry and morose previous to their coming to Krishna consciousness. But having come in contact with devotees, they are now dancing like jubilant peacocks. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamaiham Tadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschati Desha Tarine Namo Mahavadanyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namne Gaurat Vishena Maha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchina Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpataru Bhyascha Kripasindhu Bhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shrivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. So this morning we are discussing one of the most metaphorical chapters of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where observations of nature, especially the nature of Srila Vrindavan Dham, triggers off spiritual contemplations in the mind of Shukadev Goswami. And he shares those contemplations with all of us through the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, in general, the way Srila Prabhupada presented Krishna consciousness was quite literalist, in the sense that he said, let us take the literal meaning of the scriptures and not screw out some unwarranted metaphorical interpretations. At the same time, the scriptures do themselves talk about metaphor. Metaphors are implied similarities. And these are used frequently in scripture. So, for example, in the fourth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, we have the whole pastime of Puranjana, which is described to be metaphorical. So, Puranjan is not a historical person, but he represents the kind of mentality that Narad Muni wants to dissect when he is instructing Prachinibari. And for that purpose, he uses a symbolic, a non-historical character, that is Puranjan. So, the metaphorical meaning is used quite frequently in the scripture. And what Srila Prabhupada was against was not the metaphorical meaning per se. He was against the metaphorical meaning supplanting the literal meaning. You know, in the third chapter of the 10th canto itself, Srila Prabhupada even talks about, represents how Devaki represents fear of material existence, and the six children that were born to her, they represent the six anarthas, and Kamsa is the dangerous material existence. So, Prabhupada does give non-literal explanations also. So, non-literal explanations are not necessarily wrong. Non-literal explanations should supplement, not supplant, the literal explanations. Supplement means add to. Supplant means replace. So, Vrindavan is a place that is historically real. In fact, it's not just historically real, it is transcendentally real. It exists in the spiritual realm eternally. And it's interesting that normally we think of advanced Krishna consciousness as, now whatever we see, we connect with Krishna. And normally if somebody talks about philosophy, we think, okay, this is preliminary. And pastimes are very advanced. You think somebody talks about pastime, somebody talks about rasa, somebody talks about Krishna, relationship with Krishna and the gopis, that is very advanced. So, normally we think of philosophy as preliminary to later on get to pastimes. But here we see, Shukdev Goswami is in the heart of the Bhagavatam, he is in the 10th canto, he is describing Krishna's pastimes, he is in Krishna's abode in the narrative course, and there in the forest of Vrindavan, he is not contemplating on Krishna's pastimes, he is contemplating on basic philosophical truths. Why is that? That is, there are multiple reasons, but the important point relevant for us is that it is not that remembering the basic principles of Krishna consciousness is preliminary. Now, what is important is what is relevant for the audience. No, Shukadeva Goswami is speaking to Parikshit Maharaj, who is preparing for the final exam of death. And for that preparation, he is narrating the pastimes along with the philosophical import of those pastimes. So, in this context, it's not that Parikshit Maharaj is not an advanced devotee. He's Vishnu Ratha, he's absorbed in Lord Vishnu. But in this context of illustrating what is the duty of a person about to die, philosophy is important. And if we see, the Bhagavatam concludes also, 12.4, 12.5 is the place where, 12th canto, 4th and 5th chapter is the place where Shukdev Goswami's narration ends. And Shukdev Goswami departs. And Parikshit Maharaj absorbs himself in spiritual reality and departs from the world when the Takshaka bird comes and bites. So, there also, just before departing, Shukadeva Goswami speaks philosophy. He speaks actually Atma Tattva. Of course, Chakravarti Pad gives a very esoteric explanation of why he talks about Atma Tattva over there. But the point here is that philosophy is not unimportant. And remembering philosophy helps us in remembering Krishna. Siddhanta baliya chitte na kare alas. Iha haite Krishna lage sudrudha manas. By remembering the philosophy, we understand the futility of material things, and thereby we get an impetus to fix our mind on Krishna. We understand that Krishna is the only ultimate reality. And therefore, it's important for us to fix the mind on Krishna. So Shukadeva Goswami is illustrating this point. So it's seeing the peacocks. We could normally think, oh, peacock has a complex peacock feather, Krishna wears a peacock feather, and seeing a peacock might remind a person of Krishna. But here, seeing a peacock reminds him of how the conditioned souls become happy when they get the opportunity for Krishna consciousness. So Srila Prabhupada talks about how his Western disciples, and we could include all of us who are Westernized followers in that same category. You know, so actually, the Prabhupada often says hippies have become happies. So to some extent, this is a journey. The hippies were living in quintessential tamoguna, you know, rejecting all regulative principles and unclean lives. And Krishna describes that a characteristic of the mode of goodness is happiness. And of course, transcendence is filled with happiness. So the journey, when Prabhupada says Krishna consciousness has made people from hippies to happies, that essentially means it has raised people from the lower modes, from the mode of ignorance, say, to the mode of goodness and beyond to transcendence. So, we will discuss today a bit about happiness in Krishna consciousness. So, the first point to understand that happiness is always a byproduct, never a product. What this means is that if we chase after happiness, if we do a particular activity just so that we'll become happy, we will soon find happiness eluding us. When people start out doing something which they do, I'll do only for enjoyment. If people go for a picnic, a outing, a hill station, whatever, I'll go only for enjoying. Then after some time, people become bored with the enjoyment. You know, when people watch movies, or whatever they do, normally the level of enjoyment, that becomes boring, and that's why the shock value, the surprise value, the stimulation value of that enjoyment has to keep rising, rising, rising. That's how people feel a bit stimulated. Otherwise, there's no happiness. So when we chase after happiness, we never get happiness. Even at a material level, happiness is a byproduct of dedication to some meaningful cause. Even in material life, the people who are happy are those who are dedicated to some cause. And in the absorption in that cause, in the selfless consumption in that cause, they experience happiness as a byproduct. And even in the path of bhakti, actually, happiness is a byproduct of selfless devotion to Krishna. The Bhagavatam 1.26 says, Savai pumsam paro dharmo yato bhakti radhokshaje ahaitukiya pratihata. Yayatma suprasidati. So this verse is describing the characteristics of the supreme dharma. That which is unmotivated and uninterrupted devotion to the transcendental Lord. That is the supreme dharma. But what it says is, this supreme dharma will, as a byproduct, yayatma suprasidati. It will lead to inner happiness. It will lead to most fulfilling happiness. But the emphasis is, that is a result which will come. But what we should focus on is ahaitukiya pratihata bhakti. So even on the path of bhakti, you know, if we do the activities of devotional service so that we will become happy, then happiness will often elude us. Because happiness is not a product, it's a byproduct. You know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains in the Chaitanya Shikshamrit that because the jivatma is an amsha of Krishna, so everything that Krishna has is present in a fragmental, minute way in the Jivatma. So Krishna has his own Ladini Shakti, his pleasure-giving potency. So, if the Jivatma is a part of Krishna, does the Jivatma also have his own Ladini Shakti? Does he have his own pleasure-giving potency? He says, yes. But because we are tiny, our pleasure-giving potency, or pleasure gaining potency, whichever we want to put it, we want to gain pleasure. So the potency that gives us pleasure, the potency by which we gain pleasure, that is also extremely tiny. And that's why when the soul tries to enjoy separate from Krishna, does the soul get happiness? Yes, but it is an extremely tiny happiness. Because our potency for pleasure is extremely limited. Prahlad Maharaj talks about this. He says, కుత్రాశిష శ్రుతిసుఖం మృగతృష్ణి రూపా క్వేదం కలేవరమశేష రుజాం విరోహ నిర్విద్యతే నతు జనో యదపీతి విద్వాన్ కామానలం మధుల వైశామయందురాపై. సో యాక్చువల్లీ ఇన్ దిస్ వర్స్ హీ గివ్స్ టూ డిఫరెంట్ కన్సెప్షన్స్ ఆఫ్ వెదర్ దెర్ ఇస్ హ్యాపీనెస్ ఇన్ ద మెటీరియల్ వరల్డ్ ఆర్ నాట్. హీ ఫస్ట్ సేస్ దట్ వాట్ ఇస్ ద హ్యాపీనెస్ ఇన్ మెటీరియల్, కుత్ర ఆశీష్ వాట్ కెన్ ఐ డిజైర్ ఇన్ దిస్ మెటీరియల్ వరల్డ్, బికాస్ ఆల్ ద హ్యాపీనెస్ హియర్ ఇస్ శృతి సుఖ మృగ తృష్ణి రూప. వి ఆల్ హియర్ అబౌట్ ఇట్ కాన్స్టెంట్లీ, బట్ వెన్ వీ ట్రై టు ఎక్స్పీరియన్స్ ఇట్, ఇట్ ఇస్ లైక్ అ మిరాజ్ ఇన్ ద డెజర్ట్. ఇట్స్ నాట్ దేర్ ఓన్లీ మృగ తృష్ణి రూప, బట్ దెన్ సంబడి మే సే నో దేర్ ఇస్ హ్యాపీనెస్ ఇన్ ద మెటీరియల్ వరల్డ్. సో యాజ్ అ కన్సెషన్ ఓకే, ఈవెన్ ఇఫ్ దెర్ ఇస్ హ్యాపీనెస్ ఇట్ ఇస్ మధులవై, ఇట్ ఇస్ జస్ట్ అ డ్రాప్. ద వర్డ్ లవ్ వి యూజ్ ఇట్ మోర్ కామన్ ఇన్ లవ్ మాత్ర సాధు సంఘ, ఇట్స్ వెరీ స్మాల్ ఫ్రాగ్మెంట్. మధులవై మీన్స్ ఎక్స్ట్రీమ్లీ లిటిల్ హ్యాపీనెస్. సో as compared to the need for water in the desert, a drop of water is not going to satisfy. Similarly, as compared to the need for happiness of the soul, which is constant, the intermittent, transitory, flickering happiness that is there in material existence is never going to be sufficient. So the mirage is not so much, the mirage example is given, not so much to say that there is no happiness at all in material existence. In the Taittiriya Upanishad, there is a hierarchy of happiness that is replicated with some modification in the Bhakta Rasamrita Sindhu also. And it talks about, say, the earthly happiness is this much, the swargiya happiness 100 times. Then the happiness is in Brahmaloka is 1,000 times. Or some proportion is there. Then the Brahmananda is this much, 1,000 times that. And then ultimately Bhaktiananda is much, much greater than that. So there's a hierarchy of happiness which is talked about, which indicates if the heavenly happiness is 1,000 times earthly happiness, and like that 1,000 times you multiply, you get the spiritual happiness, then obviously the material happiness is not zero. Because if it were zero, then 1,000 times you multiply, it will still say zero only. So there is some happiness in material existence. So when the mirage example is given, not so much to talk about the non-existence of the happiness, but it is given to illustrate the illusion about the nature and quantity of the happiness. No, the mirage basically represents an illusion. And what is the illusion? The illusion is that there is so much happiness in this world that it's worth giving our whole life to pursue it, and it's the happiness that will make us happy. No, there is happiness in this world, but it is very temporary. It is not going to make us happy because it will come and it will go. So, why is our happiness so flickering, so temporary? Because we are parts of Krishna, but because we are tiny parts of Krishna, the happiness that we experience in connection with Krishna, without connection with Krishna, is tiny. Because our pleasure-gaining potency is extremely tiny. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that the way the soul can experience happiness is when he connects his tiny pleasure's potency with Krishna's infinite pleasure potency. So then what happens is, that means we have the desire for pleasure and all our activities are motivated by that desire for pleasure. But when we use this motivational energy, this impetus, to serve Krishna, to love Krishna, to please Krishna, then we connect with Krishna's unlimited pleasure potency. And then that gives us far, far greater happiness than what we would get independent of Krishna. So, happiness of Krishna consciousness comes when we serve Krishna. So the primary focus of a devotee is on serving Krishna. And then as a byproduct of serving Krishna, happiness results. So, when we practice Krishna consciousness, often, we also have our struggles. You know, we are tempted by material pleasures. We sometimes succumb to those material temptations. And we sometimes experience spiritual happiness. Sometimes it comes, sometimes it goes. Our experience of spiritual happiness also doesn't stay constant on most occasions. Now, why is that? That is because our connection with Krishna is not constant. Bhaktivinoda Thakur used the example that the sun is constantly giving light. But a person who is under the clouds cannot constantly see the light. So we are under the cloud of our conditionings right now. And because of that, because of the cloud of our conditionings, our connection with Krishna is intermittent. It is not constant. And because our connection with Krishna is intermittent, so even our experience of spiritual happiness is intermittent. To the extent we become purified and our conditioning decreases, that means the clouds go away, to that extent our connection with Krishna will become constant. And then our experience of spiritual happiness will also become consistent. So during this process, when we are trying to serve Krishna, trying to get rid of our conditionings, often Maya misdirects us in various ways. One of the ways which Maya may tempt a very new spiritual seeker is by promising that material happiness is better, greater, and just forget spirituality. But for serious devotees, that's not what Maya does. You know, Maya makes us Krishna unconscious within Krishna consciousness. Maya makes us Krishna unconscious within Krishna consciousness. How does that happen? Now, often, our own definition of happiness becomes our greatest obstacle to happiness. What does that mean? Our definition to happiness becoming an obstacle to our happiness. Now, often we come to we come to Krishna consciousness. With particular plans. Okay, I'll do this service, I'll do this, I'll do that. And it's important. We want to do practical services for Krishna. But ultimately our goal is not just to do services, just not to get things done, but it is to be conscious of Krishna. So often we are, even when we are within the realm of devotional service, we are more conscious of what I am going to do for Krishna than we are conscious of Krishna. And when what I am going to do for Krishna doesn't work out, I become so frustrated that I am no longer conscious of Krishna. So when I am trying to do something for Krishna, I am concentrating on myself. Yes, I want to do this. And when I am not able to do that, again I am conscious of myself. Oh, I couldn't do it. And in both cases, we are actually not Krishna conscious. Of course, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't do our services to Krishna. Certainly we have to do our services and we have to have plans also, so that we can do services properly for Krishna's sake. But at the same time, we have to be open to Krishna at all times. Now, Krishna often comes softly in our life. He comes softly in our life and he comes from unexpected directions. Now, if we are waiting at the door to meet somebody, and suppose that person is already waiting inside the house, you know, then we are not expecting in that direction. So we assume that the success of our Krishna consciousness means that things should work out in a particular way. Okay, I am giving a class, many people should come, many people should appreciate, many people should become devotees, or whatever. If I am going for distribution, many people should take books, and whatever. We all have our own definitions of success within Krishna consciousness. And these definitions are important. But happiness in Krishna consciousness is not dependent on that definition of success. But when our mind is wedded to that definition of success, then we can't become happy independent of that definition. That means, if I am going to give a class and I find that very few people have come for the class, then if my happiness is dependent on how many people are there for the class or how much people appreciate my class, then I can't appreciate the remembrance of Krishna that is there for available for me when I am preparing for the class, when I am speaking in the class. After the class also, I have contemplated on Krishna. Similarly, when we are distributing books, you know, for us, the opportunity to serve Krishna itself is the source of purification. Itself is a source of advancement. Certainly, we want results for Krishna's service. But the results don't determine our advancement in Krishna consciousness. It's our endeavor. And Krishna is pleased even by our endeavor. So, sometimes when we make plans and the plans don't work, then we just stop making plans. And then what happens when we don't make plans? Then the mind makes plans for us. So either way, we seem to get into trouble. When we make plans, we become so control driven. This is how I want to work. This is how I want to work. And when it doesn't work, we become frustrated. And we say, I'll not make plans only. Actually, you know, plans usually don't work, but planning works. There's a difference between the two. The difference between plans and planning is that plans are specific. Planning is more generic. Now, planning enables us to come overall towards the mode of goodness. Now, okay, this it gives us a general compass for our life. Okay, these are the things I have to do. This is the direction in which I have to move. So, when Krishna talks about, in 6.18, he talks about, yuktahara viharasya yukta cheshtasya karmasu yukta sapnava bodhasya yogo bhavati dukkha. It's very interesting what this verse says. We generally quote the first part of the verse, that yukta, be regulated. Be regulated in eating, be regulated in sleeping, be regulated in recreation, be regulated in work. But Krishna says something very significant in the last line of this verse. He says, when we are regulated in our bodily activities, then yogo bhavati dukkha. Then the practice of yoga will free us from misery. So it's interesting that the practice of yoga is supposed to free us from misery. That's what we want in our spiritual life. But he says, the practice of yoga will free us from misery when we are regulated in our material life. Why? So this regulation is essentially nothing but planning. How will I know what is regulated? You know, what is the appropriate, what is not too much, what is not too little? That is basically, it will come by planning. But what happens is that bhakti can be started from any mode. You know, a person can be in ignorance, a person can be in passion. A person can start bhakti. But if a person has to practice bhakti as a sustained sadhana, some level of goodness is required. Without goodness, one cannot be a sustained sadhaka. So there's a difference between a bhakta and a sadhaka. A bhakta is anyone who has bhakti. And bhakti can be little, it can be large amount of bhakti. But a sadhaka is one who is following the systematic discipline of sadhana bhakti. So for example, within Krishna consciousness, Srila Prabhupada has given us 16 rounds, he has given us 4 regulatory principles. So if one wants to be a sadhaka, one has to have some level of goodness. Without that, we will not be able to sustain ourselves in sadhana. So what Krishna is telling over here is that by becoming yukta, these are the three modes, ignorance, passion, goodness, then it is the yukta, the regulation that will bring us to goodness. And then when we practice yoga, yoga bhavati dukkha, then from goodness, by the practice of yoga, we move towards transcendence, where we become free from misery. So, actually, our preconceptions, our definitions of what all I am supposed to do in Krishna consciousness, that often obstructs us. Because that doesn't allow us to be conscious of Krishna. So, it's a, again, the difference between, as it plans and planning, the difference is, when we become too caught up in specific plans, then it's very easy to go into the mode of passion. Okay, this is what I want to do, this is what I want to do, this is what I want to do. Then it becomes a controllership mentality, and then that takes us into passion. Whereas planning as a general mental disposition is indicative of goodness. So, yuktahara viharasya is talking about a general regulation for our lives. And to the extent we have our material side regulated and balanced, to that extent, that becomes a foundation by which we can go to the spiritual level. So, in bhakti, now the point which we started this discussion was that the happiness in Krishna consciousness is a byproduct. It is not a product. It is a byproduct of service to Krishna. And the more we become absorbed in service to Krishna, the more this happiness will come as a byproduct. So, as sadhakas, the primary focus in sadhana bhakti is to try our best to serve Krishna. You know, one of the best ways to make ourselves miserable is to ask ourselves, am I happy? Because once we start asking that question, am I happy, we just give a free play for the mind. And the mind starts playing its various games. The mind plays the game of comparison, mind plays the game of complaint, the mind plays the game of seeing all the things that are wrong in our life. Basically, rather than asking whether I am happy or not, if we focus more on, am I serving Krishna or not? How can I serve Krishna better? Now, serving Krishna better may sometimes require some material adjustments also. That is okay, but it is not the material adjustments that will make us happy. It is the connection with Krishna that will make us happy. So, now within Vedic culture, there was the Varnashram. So Srila Prabhupada, if we look at his letters, lectures, and even the purports that he wrote in between 1965 to 1970, there Srila Prabhupada's general emphasis was on that actually the Varnashram has become the caste system in India and the caste system has failed. So there is no need for this caste, for this Varnashram. People can just practice Krishna consciousness and transcend themselves. But from the 70s onwards, and especially from 74 onwards, Srila Prabhupada's letters, lectures, conversations, they talk about a sustained emphasis on Varnashram. So Srila Prabhupada emphasizes that we have to have a Varnashram system by which people can practice Krishna consciousness steadily. So what happened? You know, actually speaking, we often think of the Acharya as normative. Normative means that whatever the Acharya speaks is the absolute truth and it is the unchanging absolute truth. Well, the Acharya himself speaks changing things at different times. And there are many places we will see Prabhupada makes different statements based on the context. So what happened between the 1960s and 1970s that made Srila Prabhupada change this? See, several things happened. In the 1960s, there was no Krishna consciousness movement at all. But by the 1970s, as the Krishna consciousness movement started developing, then there was significant difficulty in both the primary ashrams that were visible, in the Brahmacharya, in the renounced ashram, as well as in the Grahastha ashram. In the Grahastha ashram, there were a lot of conflicts and there were divorces. In the renounced ashram, the renunciates had difficulties in following the standards. And as these problems became more and more, Srila Prabhupada felt that actually for devotees to be able to practice Krishna consciousness in a sustained way, they need a supportive social structure. So, actually speaking, bhakti is transcendental. Bhakti is beyond the material world. And bhakti does not require Varnashram per se. You will see, if we look at the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, in the 64 elements of bhakti, there is no reference to Varnashram as given by Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Even in the commentary of, say, Jiva Goswami, Durgam Sangamani, or Chakravarti Path's commentary on Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, there is no reference to Varnashram per se as an emphatic limb. Now, the Varnashram is talked about first time in a clear and distinctive way in our tradition by Bhakti Vinod Thakur, where he talks about three Varnashramas. Roughly, he uses Asuri Varanashram, Vaidik Varanashram, and Vaigyanik Varanashram, he calls it. Vaigyanik Varanashram is scientific or Daivi Varanashram. So, Asuri Varanashram is what exists today in society. That means, what exists today in society is the caste by birth. So, you know, the birthright made it wrong. The whole idea that thinking that caste is a birthright, that made the whole system wrong. And that is demoniac. It is Asuri Varanashram. The Vaidik Varanashram was generally by birth. No, in general, in the Vedic culture, if a person was born in a Brahminical family, that person would become a Brahmana. So, the Vedic Varnashram system was by birth, but it was understood that birth was the foundation for subsequent development of qualities. The difference between Asuri and Vedic Varnashram is that the birth itself is assumed to be the qualification. Whereas in Vedic Varnashram, birth was understood to be the beginning qualification. And from there one has to proceed forward. So in the four Vedas primarily, you know, there are exceptions, but not many, of people from Varvarana taking up the profession of another Varana. They are there, but not many. And that is to be respected. And that's why Krishna talks about this point, Shriyan Swadharmo Viguna Paradharmat Sunushtitat. The same verse fragment comes twice, once in the 3rd chapter and once in the 18th chapter. So Krishna offers deference, respect to the Varnashram system. Now what is this Vaigyanik Varnashram, or as he calls it, Daivi Varnashram? This is in the Daivi Varnashram, we accept Varnashram as a social structure. That means, see, the whole idea of Varnashram is not that there are different people of different castes. It's rather there are four broad human types. Whichever society we go to, there are intellectuals, there are administrators, there are business people, and there are general assistants, there are laborers. So whichever society we go to. So the whole purpose of Varnashram is that train people according to their propensities. So what does Varnashram do? Varnashram enables people to find some dharmic material happiness while they are pursuing transcendental happiness. A Kshatriya, when he is doing Kshatriya work, it is not that all the happiness that Kshatriya gains while ruling the kingdom, while marrying some princesses, while defeating invaders, it's not that all the happiness the Kshatriya is experiencing is transcendental. Even if the Kshatriya is a devotee, still there is so much interaction with the material energy. But because that Kshatriya is having the nature of Sattva Rajoguna that characterizes Kshatriya, so that kind of life gives the person a dharmic material happiness. It's happiness that's according to one's material nature. So in that sense, it's material. Now, we'll not go into a hair-splitting analysis here of what is material happiness and what is spiritual happiness. And you could say everything that is experienced in the service of Krishna is spiritual happiness. That is fine. If everything that we experience in Krishna's service is spiritual happiness, then why does sweet rice taste more tasty to us than rice? Isn't it? Both are prasad. So, both are prasad. So, if we're just tasting it spiritually, then both should be equally tasty. But we find sweet rice more tasty than rice. So, we can't discount the material aspect of things. So, when people do things which are compatible with their material nature, they experience a material happiness. But if they are doing those material activities according to the Varnashram, according to the framework of Dharma, then that gives them a dharmic material happiness. And this dharmic material happiness supports them in the journey towards spiritual happiness. So the whole system of Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha is what? It provides people dharmic happiness. And most of the happiness is material happiness. But it is religious material happiness. So now, in devotional service, of course, whatever we are doing is ultimately aimed for transcendence. But even while we are aiming for transcendence, all of us are individuals. And all of us have our individual propensities. So, when we are engaged in a way that is compatible with our propensities, then we experience a happiness at the material level, a harmonization at the material level, that makes us peaceful for the practice of spiritual life. So, when I said earlier that we shouldn't seek for happiness at the material level, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't necessarily serve according to our nature. No, whatever is our nature, we need to serve according to that. And it's not easy, especially in Kali Yuga, to discover what our nature is. So, the problem is that our mind is so flickering that it doesn't allow us to really ponder on whatever is our nature. So it just goes from here and there and here and there. So we may not be able to discover our nature immediately, but overall it's not difficult to discern where our inclinations are and what we are comfortable doing, what we are not comfortable doing. And over a period of time, we will naturally gravitate towards the kind of activities, the kind of services, the kind of association, even within devotee association, that is according to our nature. That is according to our inclinations. Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls this as Sajatiya Ashasanga. He says association that is of the association that is of a similar mental disposition as our own. So now, when we are pursuing happiness in devotional service, that means our ultimate goal is to connect with Krishna. And our focus is on connecting with Krishna, not so much on becoming happy. But how do we connect with Krishna? That is according to our psychophysical nature. That is according to our inclinations. So, when we connect with Krishna that way, it's not that suppose somebody has the Brahminical tendency. Now, it's not that if a person with a Brahminical tendency gets a Brahminical engagement, that will make the person happy. No. Even a person with a Brahminical inclination and getting a Brahminical engagement, still, even for such a person, the material world remains dukkhalayam ashashvatam. And even for such a person, there will be misery. But, you know, there are different kinds of problems in material existence. There are some problems which we like to face and some problems which we don't like to face. What that means is, if a person with a Brahminical orientation is told, okay, can you please find where this verse is? It's okay, yes, good, I'll find it out. Now somebody with a Vaishya propensity is told, can you find where this verse is? He says, there's so thousands of verses, where will I find the verse? Why do you need the verse? Forget, give the class without the verse. What is the big deal? On the other hand, if somebody with a Vaishya propensity is told, we want to build a big temple. We need to raise, 5 crore rupees. Oh, very good. He says, okay, I'll make this plan. And within maybe 5 days, the person will make a plan for raising 50 crore rupees. And if a Brahminical person is told, we have to make a plan. We have to raise 5 crore rupees. He says, why do you need? Just chant Hare Krishna wherever you are. Just study scripture and be happy. So, the point is that, according to our nature, there are certain problems that we like to face and there are certain problems which we don't like to face. So, material existence is problematic for everyone. But what Varnashram does is, Varnashram allocates people the kind of problems that they will like to face. And, so, in positive thinking, people talk about, don't talk about difficulties as problems. Talk about them as challenges. That's a positive way of looking at things. That's true. But, unless one has inclination to face certain situations, they will not appear as challenges. They will appear just as problems. So, we can't just wish away material nature. We have to deal with it. So, as devotees, when we are trying to serve Krishna according to our nature, then also the focus is not so much on becoming happy as it is on serving Krishna. So when we are serving Krishna according to our nature, there are dangers in that also. Earlier I discussed that when we try to serve Krishna independent of our nature, what happens is there is so much material agitation and irritation that we can't focus on Krishna consciousness. But on the other hand, when we are trying to serve Krishna according to our nature, there is another set of problems. The problem is that when we do something according to our nature, we can do it well. And it creates very easily the illusion of doership. If somebody is not a good cook, and then somebody cooks and they find that what has been cooked is not good, it's easy to say, I am not the doer. Because I didn't do anything over there. What I did is not something I am proud of. But when we do something and we do it well, at that time, it is quite easy to take up the doership mentality. Now that is the challenge. Now once, there was one devotee who used to sing kirtans very nicely. So Prabhupada was going for darshan and Prabhupada came. This devotee was singing kirtan and playing mridanga. So Prabhupada came to him and said, your kirtan is very nice. So this devotee, he felt spiritual master is appreciating, he was very happy. And then he just turned and he confessed to his heart, Prabhupada, but sometimes I feel proud. And then Prabhupada looked at him and said, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? Now we wonder, isn't everything wrong with pride? Actually speaking, pride is something which is like a disease that is there within us. And we can't wish that disease away. Pride is there. And if we don't do activities that are worthwhile in devotional service, that pride will impel us to do activities outside the realm of devotional service. That will be worthwhile. So we can't wish away pride. Now if I say, if I do something according to my nature, I'll do it well, and because of doing it well, I'll become proud. Therefore, I will not do it. That pride will not go away by that. The pride is already there as a disease. So, it's not that doing the activity which I am good at makes me proud. It is that doing the activity I am good at gives me reason to express my pride. The pride is already there in the heart. And what will remove pride is not avoiding the service, but actually doing the service in as much devotional consciousness as possible. If I don't do the service only, what will happen? Somebody else will do the service. Somebody else will take the credit.
And then my pride will express itself in ugly form as envy. Oh, that person, I could also have done that. Why is that person getting credit? So, actually speaking, the idea that because I'll become proud, so I'll not do the particular service, that is not really a devotional understanding, nor is it a philosophically correct understanding. Because philosophically, it's not that pride is not there. Just like a small child may not exhibit lust, but lust is already there. And when puberty comes, lust becomes expressed. Similarly, pride is already there within all of us. And it's not that doing services well makes us proud. It's that doing services well gives us an opportunity to express that pride. But we can also do the services well and offer the glorification, if any comes for that service, to Krishna, to Guru, to Vaishnavas. And that way, it's only when we render service to Krishna, are we taking the medicine. It's like doing the service or not doing the service, it doesn't determine whether pride is present in us or not. Pride is already present, and the cure for pride is devotional service. So only when we render devotional service can we become free from pride. So we have to have some philosophical awareness that ultimately Krishna is the blesser by whose grace we do everything. But still, the important point is that we keep doing devotional service. And as we keep doing devotional service, over a period of time, we will become purified. That's why at the foundation of Bhaktarasamrita Sindhu is the sutra. Yena kena prakarena mana krishna niveshayet. Somehow or the other fix the mind on Krishna. Somehow the other means, it is not a license for immorality or insensitivity, but it is a indication of the pragmatic necessity. Whatever way it works out, according to one's nature, according to one's circumstances, whatever way we can practice devotional service, we use it. Ultimately, practicing devotional service is like fighting a war. And when we are fighting a war, we may go with a particular strategy. We may use particular weapons. But if the particular weapon that we are using doesn't work, then we take some other weapons, find out what works, and use that weapon at that time. So, yena kena prakarena means that we have to actually, each of us, have individual initiative to find out how we can best be Krishna conscious. And then, take up that initiative for advancing in devotional service. And that way, the Nashla Prabhupada says over here that just as the peacocks become happy whenever the clouds manifest in the sky, the conditioned soul, the sadhakas, the devotees will become happy whenever there is a manifestation of Krishna, whenever there is opportunity to connect with Krishna at a deeper and greater level. So I'll quickly summarize. I started by talking about the metaphorical representation explanations should not supplant, but they can supplement the literal explanations. Then I discussed about how studying philosophy is not preliminary, it is essential for fixing the mind on Krishna. And even in the Bhagavatam 10th canto, Sukadeva Goswami is remembering philosophy. Then I discussed about happiness in Krishna consciousness. Therein I discussed three main points. First is that it is a byproduct, not a product. And then we have to focus on connecting ourselves with Krishna. And a byproduct of that will be happiness. Then for connecting with Krishna, I discussed about Varanashram and how we have to find how we can connect with Krishna in a way that is most compatible to our natures. And then lastly, I discussed that even while connecting with Krishna, if we become proud, still we should not give up the connection with Krishna, give up the service to Krishna, but rather try to do that service in a way that will keep us free from pride. Yena kena prakarena. Somehow or other, we stay connected with Krishna. So thank you very much. Is there any one question quickly? Yes, Rajvi Hari.
Hare Krishna. Thank you so much, Prabhu. A beautiful class. Actually, I had two questions, but since you said one, I'll ask only one. You are mentioning about, within the Krishna consciousness, we could be Krishna unconscious. And you are explaining about engaging in services, knowing our nature. I just wanted to know how can, as we grow older, we get lot of responsibilities and lot of services, and we want to, it's not that we don't want to do services, but it's not practically possible to do services, like so much, as we grow older we get lot of responsibilities. So we want to do services according to our nature. So it becomes imperative for us to discover our nature. So I wanted to know how we could actually discover our nature, and then if we know our nature, it also means we may have to say no to many things and many devotees, and that means not fulfilling the expectations of so many Vaishnavas. So how do we deal with that aspect? So basically two things. One is how to know our nature so that we can serve Krishna happily, and secondly, if we know our nature, then we may have to say no, and that means not satisfying the expectations of so many Vaishnavas. So how do we deal with that?
Yeah. So how do we know our nature? And if we serve according to our nature, how can we say no to the services which are not according to our nature? Generally, if something is according to our nature, then first thing is that we'll be good at it, doing it. That's just the result of that being compatible with our nature. And secondly, there'll be very little inner conflict or resentment or irritation while doing it. There'll be a greater amount of, say, satisfaction, comfort, we could say, while doing the activity that are according to our nature. So that means, say, external competence and inner satisfaction. If you observe these, then that is a reasonable barometer of whether something is according to our nature or not. And in general, in the initial stages of a spiritual life, we do various services, and while doing services, we can observe ourselves. And it's a matter of surrender for us that we do whatever services we are told to. But it's also a matter of responsibility for us to observe. Because it's not that throughout our spiritual life, somebody is going to be there to instruct us, do this, do this, do this, do this throughout the day. No, we will have to take up initiative in our spiritual life. So observing where we are most competent externally as well as most satisfied internally, that is a good barometer for us to understand our nature. And regarding saying no to certain services, certain engagements, it's a matter of, I would say, honest communication. Honest and sincere communication. If generally, within an institution, there are many things to be done, and naturally, those who are having the responsibility of getting those things done will want devotees to do those services. So that is important. At the same time, ultimately the institution is made up of individuals. And only when the individuals are at least to a basic extent satisfied, will the institution flourish. So over a period of time, if we clearly explain that why we want to do certain things, want to focus on certain things, and not do certain things, and if we communicate it properly, generally it should not be very difficult. It's only if we are ourselves very inconsistent, then it becomes a problem. That means whenever we don't want to do something, we say it's not in my nature. But then later on we do the same thing again afterwards for some other purpose or in some other circumstance. Then it becomes a little problematic. But as our movement grows, there will be lesser sort of, say, pressure on the devotees, because we will have more devotees also, and there will be different devotees who can do different services. So in the pioneer phase of any project, now there will be the pressure for everybody to do whatever is required. But over a period of time, then there will be the facility for specialization. And that's how our movement will also become deep-rooted and respectable. Only when we have specialists. So now there is gradually an encouragement. If devotees want to specialize in certain fields, there is an encouragement for that. And we can be humble, but at the same time, we can be firm about certain things. It's a matter of communication. If we communicate properly, then things will work out. That's my understanding. You'd like to add something, you can yourself tell. Okay, yes, Rajivasi Prabhu.
Prabhuji, I was just wanted to clarify one thing about, you made a point that when we ask, am I happy in this material world, then we become more miserable. But actually the Varnashrama itself is finding some material happiness and be honest about it.
Correct. Okay.
So I think we are not honest to accept that I need some material happiness and I am on the Sakam Karma platform, and not on the na dhanam na janama sundarim. So I think it is good to ask whether I am happy
okay,
or not.
Yes, good point. Actually, so we need to ask ourselves whether I am happy or not. Then only we can find out according to whether varnashram we are happy. Yes, I also made that point. Internal satisfaction is a criteria for judging what is our nature and what is the appropriate service. When I said asking whether I am happy, it is a recipe for making ourselves unhappy. What it means is that on a moment-to-moment basis, if that is a question we are asking, then our focus is very self-centered. Then what will happen is that we will not really be service-oriented. So that way the mind will always find some reason to keep us dissatisfied. So there are periodic times when we can pause and reflect. So generally evaluating whether we are happy or not should be done when we are peaceful, when we are relatively in the mode of goodness. Now if we are in the thick of action, and especially generally speaking, even though we are practicing devotional service, when we are in thick of action, it, to some extent we are in Rajoguna. And one of the characteristics of Rajoguna is to keep us dissatisfied. So, lobha pravritti marambha karmana mashima spruha rajasyetani jayante vivruddhe kurunandana. So, 14 point is lobha, greed, dissatisfaction. So, if in the heat of the moment, that means if constantly we are thinking, am I happy, am I happy, am I happy, then because at that time we are not in a position for calm reflection, the default answer will be, no, I am not happy. This is wrong, that is wrong, that is wrong, that is wrong. So, periodically, in times of reflection, we should definitely evaluate whether I am happy or not. Now, as devotees, at least what I can say, and most of us can say, if somebody asks us whether we are happy or not, now happiness is a process. And we are on that process. Surely I am much happier than what I was 10 or 15 years ago. And I can see that I am happier than what I was 5 years ago, 7 years ago. So we are on the journey towards happiness. That we can observe, and we can see that those who are more advanced than us, they are having a deeper level of happiness than us. So surely we want to check whether we are on that right path. And therefore asking that question is good, but it should be done not on a moment-to-moment basis, but during periods of calm reflection. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai. Tai Gaur Premanande. Thank you very much.